Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine, as people, regular listeners will know, does it does filtered water. It's chilled, and it does chilled sparkling filtered water too. It's absolutely fantastic, and thank you for Cooker for sponsoring this podcast. Today's guest, it's an hour of conversation with Philippa Perry, who's a psychotherapist. She's married to Grayson Perry, the artist, who you probably all know, and she's written a book called The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read, and Your Children Will Be Glad That You Did. She came on Sunday Brunch. She was brilliant, such a lovely guest, charming, smart, everything about her was brilliant. So I thought, hey, why not get her on the podcast and see if we can chew over what it's like to be a parent. And also we discuss a lot of other things like relationships and where the world's going. So it's worth listening. Here's an hour with Philippa Perry. Philippa, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
I was just saying, did you enjoy coming on Sunday Brunch? Thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show.
Well, that's very kind of you to have me. And had I been able to taste those lovely little dishes you were making there, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. But, you know, I enjoyed you via the medium of Zoom and my cornflakes, yes.
So the book has been such a success, hasn't it? Why did you write the book in the first place? Let's remind ourselves.
I wrote the book in the first place because there were an awful lot of well-meaning parents who didn't seem to realise that what they needed to have with their children was a relationship. We get the idea that children are a job and we've got to do a good job. So they get this idea that these people are something that are done to. And that was actually not helping child-parent relationships at all. And there was a lot of myths going around hurting people, really, such as, you know, children have to know what suffering is, otherwise they'll never know how to deal with it, and stuff like that, that I had to undo. That is not true. Children will suffer anyway. There's nothing you can do about that. You don't have to add to it just to toughen them up. No, please don't do that.
Yeah, there's lots of myths, isn't there, about bringing up children. I'm reading your book again. I read it ages ago when it first came out, actually, in hardback. And I'm sort of reading through it yet again. There's so much in your book, isn't there? I mean, it's a great read. There's a lot of interrogation of yourself when you're...
Yeah.
I don't mean you personally. I mean, I have to interrogate myself constantly whilst reading the book. Do you think that's the key to having good relationships?
Well, you are half of every relationship you have. So it's good to know what you're bringing to it, isn't it? It's good to know whether you're relating to what's happening to you now in the present or whether you're in fact responding to the past when you think you're in the present. Just little things like that. And in the book, there are exercises to help you know when you're doing that and how to stop it.
And I suppose one of the big takeaways from the book is having to be truthful with yourself, having to really, when you're analyzing yourself, you have to think, why am I actually feeling this way? And a bit of regression back to your childhood and how you were parented. A lot of that in there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, sometimes we feel that, oh my God, the kids are really winding me up. You know, we feel wound up by the children and we think they are doing it to us. But in fact, they are triggering something old in us. Like, for instance, when my daughter was sort of fumbling with her shoelaces, I had a huge desire to go, oh, let me do it. Sort of being irritated by her lack of motor skills. And I stopped myself and thought, that's absolutely ridiculous. What's going on? Then I remember that's exactly what my dad would do to me. He could not bother to wait around for a child to fiddle around with her shoelaces. He just would rather get out of the door quick and for me to do everything, you know, age three at his pace. I just thought, no, I'm not going to dump my dad, who did his best, by the way, but I'm not going to dump him on my kid. So I just sit with the irritation and think, no, you take your time doing your shoelace. It's not a race. You'll get there in the end. You'll work it out. And it's such a relief when you realise that you're responding to something in the past and your kid isn't being annoying about her shoelaces. Another thing that used to get me going was when children were sort of playing in the park and shrieking with delight, but making this noise. And I'd feel myself tense up to it. I thought, well, what's that about? You know, they're supposed to be running around in a field and making a noise. Why am I tensing up at the noise? And I remembered that my mum couldn't bear it if my sister and I shrieked or made a noise. We're always told to dampen it down. So she was alive at this point. So I asked her about that. And I said, what is it about children's shrieks that you didn't like? Because I noticed I'm not keen on it either. And she said, when she was growing up, her father was a bit of an invalid. He caught a bug when he was travelling in Egypt in his 20s and he never got rid of it. He was always a bit ill and he couldn't bear noise. And so the children had to pad about the house. And so that was the original reason why she feared noise, because she feared being told off about noise. So she had this fear of noise. And I sort of just picked up on that. And if I wasn't careful and interrupted it, I would have passed it on to my kid. So we've got all these sort of old stuff from the past that we can put onto our kid. And sometimes it's more serious than that. Like I had a client who he wanted to leave his partner and his son and just see his son at weekends. He said, I'm just not cut out for this parenting lot. I just can't do it. And I asked him about, his son was just coming up to 2 years old. And I said, well, you've managed it for 2 years. What is it about now? He went, oh, nothing. No, I'm fine. No, I just don't like it. Don't like it. And I just thought I just got a feeling of a sort of something really heavy going on that he was denying. Because I sort of felt this heaviness in me when I was talking to him. And I asked him what happened to him when he was two. And he went, nothing. Had a lovely childhood. My mum was really gorgeous. And I said, what about your dad? Oh, he left when I was two. Mm. But it was fine. I didn't really know him. I didn't miss him. It was fine. Yeah, we sort of see each other occasionally now, about once a year. It's fine. Mm. And I just kept tapping away. It was fine, was it? Tell me about fine. What was it like? You know, did you have nightmares? You know, this sort of thing. Sorry, my phone's going off. Just turn it off. Did you have nightmares and stuff like that? And eventually he got in touch with how he felt when he was two, which was bereft, left, rejected, miserable. And in the consulting room, he was crying, he was screaming. He was, how could you do that to your son? How could he do that to me? And then he realized, how can I do that to my son? I don't want to do that to my son.
It's funny, you know, I had kids before most of my friends, and I fell out with one because he...
One kid or one friend?
One friend. Now I look back at it was a strange thing, but my children were running around playing and being noisy, and he turned around and he shushed them. And I found it so insulting. And he went, oh, these kids, about my twins. They were only tiny.
Yeah.
And now I realized latterly, and I kind of thought at the time, but he had very strict parents and he went to boarding school.
Mm.
And so that sort of thing wasn't allowed. So he found it quite offensive. And the other thing that I know.
It's so much easier to feel irritation than it is to feel the fear.
Yeah.
So, you know, with children making a noise, that made my mum and me feel somewhat fearful.
Yeah.
That's why we wanted to shut it down.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing. And I've got a large gap between my children. I've got twins who are 18 now, and I've got a younger one who's seven. And I always say to the twins, You missed out. I'm a much better dad second time round. And there's one bit in your book that really resonates with me a lot. When you're walking along with your daughter and she just can't be bothered to go home and she's dawdling around and you're thinking, we need to get home. Then you realize that time doesn't really matter and you sit down and watch Ants together, or you watch an Ant going in our crap. And now that is how I'm with my twins. I was like, come on, we need to do this. And now with my youngest one, I would do that. I would give it time and go, yeah, it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, it's a bit more pressure when you've got two rather than when you've got one. And I wouldn't say that your younger one had a better dad. You were the best dad you could be for the twins, and they will each have their unique relationship with you, and I doubt they want to swap you.
Yeah. Well, you're right. You'll have to ask them.
And, you know, sure, you might have a different relationship with your next kid, but, you know, a bond is a bond. And a thing about whether you rushed or whether you took your time won't do much damage to that bond, because the bond is the strongest thing.
How did you become a psychotherapist?
How did I become a psychotherapist?
Yeah, what's your history?
What's my history? I don't know how I became a psychotherapist, but I have many narratives that lead up to the answer that may or may not, you know, be the answer. I guess I wanted to find out about myself and how I felt. So I was very interested in psychology, very interested in people. And I don't think you'd find many psychotherapists who had had no mental struggles, because then we just wouldn't be interested in psychology, would be. So I suppose most psychotherapists, and I'm one of them, are sort of like interested in how I can enjoy my life more, have a better life. So I studied it. And once you realize that you can, when you become aware of what you're doing, when you become more self-aware, which is why there's so much in the book about what questions to ask yourself, so you can become more self-aware, then you have a choice. Rather than just being on automatic and doing stuff that unknowingly to you, making you or the people around you unhappy, you have a choice. And when you have a choice, you can make a better choice than when you didn't know you had a choice. And I just thought this is also great that I wanted to pass it on to other people. Another narrative of why I'm a psychotherapist is that I volunteered for the Samaritans just on a sort of whim, really. This would have been mid-80s, I think. I volunteered for the Samaritans. And I thought I was volunteering because I wanted to put something back into the community, you know. But actually, what I was really doing was finding out whether it was safe to explore feelings. Now, I'd read an awful lot of stuff in my psychology researches saying it was really good to talk about how you felt and put your feelings into words. And this was the key in order to being able to contain them. But I'd been brought up to not explore feelings. Don't think that. Don't feel that. So I'd got everything shut down in a box, and I didn't know whether it was safe to explore them. Sure, I can read that it's beneficial, but that is just too big a leap for me to take. So I listened to people explore their feelings. And I found out through the bravery of the people who rang up the Samaritans that not only was it safe to explore your feelings, but it was beneficial and it was life-saving.
Can I just ask you a question in the middle of this? Do you think the reason why you were told not to explore your feelings, which is probably similar to my parents and my generation too, is it stems from my parents and their parents going through wars where it was so traumatic for them? They were losing. My mum was evacuated out of London with a family who didn't want her.
And yeah.
She has a lot of issues, not issues, but she has a lot of bad memories of that. And do you think they just think it's just easier?
I think what they had was like focus on the sunshine, you know, focus on what makes you happy, and don't dwell in the past. It's all done. It's all over. And yeah, there was that was the general you know, post-war, post both wars actually, it was don't explore your feelings was the overriding message. Another reason of don't explore your feelings is don't go into the sadness, don't go into the anger, is that your parents really want you to be happy, which comes from a good place. And what they don't know is that being able to accept yourself with all of your feelings gives you the capacity for happiness. But they didn't know that. They don't know that. And I kind of found that out doing the Samaritans, that I found it out for myself, that it does give you the capacity to happiness if you go through the sadness rather than pretend the sadness isn't there.
So what do you think makes a good psychotherapist?
Well, I think you have to be interested in people, and you have to like people. You have to love people, actually. And I think when I'm a good psychotherapist, it's when I really get the person and I love them. So you have to be a bit psychologically minded. And people say to me, you can't love people that come and see you that are really, really obnoxious. But nobody's born obnoxious. We're trained to be obnoxious. You know, if we're always told to, if we're always ignored, we'll become annoying to get noticed, because nobody wants to be not noticed. So everybody's trained to be annoying. Nobody is born annoying. And I always like to make contact with that person underneath all the neuroses that made them unhappy or made other people unhappy. And when you've got that contact and that connection, you just love them.
Mm.
And so I had a big argument with a psychoanalyst on a panel on a stage once, because he was sort of talking about very complex theories. And I'm going, no, I think it's love that actually transforms people. I think it's the relationship with the therapist that is transformative. When you are accepted and seen for who you are, and your therapist isn't horrified or disgusted and actually seems to quite like you, that is transformative.
Very true. I'm reading your
people
book.
So often aren't who they are, but try to be who they think they ought to be. And when they do that, it's very difficult for anyone to have connection or contact with them, but they don't think they're acceptable if they are just who they are. But if the therapist can meet them as who they really are and they find that that is acceptable, that is what is life-changing. And I think if a therapist is able to do that, that's what makes a good psychotherapist.
Mm. I'm reading your book. You realise that actually one of the biggest problems with the pandemic, I really struggled in the first lockdown, and I did a lot of investigating why, and I did a few podcasts on it. And it's just because we're not being very human when we're locking ourselves away. And life as a human is about communication, I believe, and about relationships. And it's, that's very prevalent in your book. It's all about relationships and how you're interacting with relationships. I think misery often, I mean, you can only make yourself, as far as I understand it, you're the only one who can make yourself happy. You're the only one who can make yourself sad. It's one player game. However, the relationships with people is...
I don't believe that, you see. I don't believe you're the only person that can make yourself happy and the only person that can make yourself sad. I think you can be done to in a big way. I think if you got into a default mood when you were very young of always being angry, I think you grow up angry and you stay angry. And if you're angry because you've never heard or never understood, that is a co-created position to be in. And I think we form in relationships, and I think when we reform, we need to do it in relationship as well. We are pack animals. We're not really supposed to do stuff on our own. Sure, we can do stuff on our own that makes us feel better, like we can learn a breathing exercise, that will learn how to meditate, that can calm down a very busy mind or something like that. But this only scratches the surface. It doesn't, what we need, we become who we are when we experience ourselves with other people. Sure, we experience ourselves when we're by ourselves and with ourselves, but we get the experience of us reflected back to us through the eyes of other people. And that can make you happy and that can make you miserable.
But it's you who's seeing it, and it's you who's making the changes.
Well, you are what part of it, yeah. You have some control over it, but people ask me, how can I be happy? And I say, choose your parents very, very carefully.
Ah, that's good. Though, if you're waiting to view the way that other people see you, then...
You don't wait. It happens instantaneously, doesn't it?
Yeah, though the way society's set up is a bit sick and a bit ill in my regard in many ways. So I wouldn't take...
That's a belief system.
Yeah, but I wouldn't take what other people are thinking too seriously, because they've all got their own problems and their own parenting issues and their own problems for their lives. And so, you know,
if troll, I wouldn't take any notice of trolls, sure. But if one person thinks you're crazy, then, you know, they might be just projecting on you. If three people that you know and respect think you're crazy, it might be a good idea to listen to them. You know, it's sort of like, there's a bit of consensus here. And if everybody thinks you're crazy, either you need another bunch of friends or you need to listen to them. And, you know, that's really cool.
I'm happier, Philippa, deciding how I feel about myself. If I'm really...
I think true. How you feel about yourself,
I think I conduct myself well, and I think I'm a nice person. So that
is influenced by a lot of people think well of Tim Lovejoy. A lot of people respect you. A lot of people think you do a great job. There are three people who think you are the best dad in the world. All these things really affect you and really add to your self-esteem, and you can't do them on your own.
Okay. So what's interesting is that thinking about relationships in your book is when you meet someone, it's we're not talking about children here, we're talking about another adult. You're coming with all your parenting issues, everything else. They're coming with all theirs. It's funny because you think the idea of it actually working is is so remote that obviously it's not, because there's plenty of successful relationships out there, but it just feels that it's so complicated. It's such a maze to get through to actually get to the end where you're happy with each other and sustain it.
I mean, some couples therapists, you know, when they've got two people in the room with them with their relationship dilemma or difficulty or just want to work on themselves, one of the things they do is see how many people are in fact in the room. You know, we've got a set of parents, two sets of grandparents, all the siblings, all the way those people have made you feel have a bearing on your relationship now. And it's quite interesting and sometimes helpful to unpick all that.
Yeah. So I always think about, can I take you for an example? Equality in relationships is very important, isn't it? That you feel equal in a relationship. And
I don't know. That's a very interesting one. My husband has a thing that no one ever fantasizes about equality in a sexual relationship. He tells this story of a guy who lived between two tube stations, West Hampstead and Kilburn. He was a gay guy. And if he was trying to get off with someone who was a bit posh, he'd say he came from Kilburn. And if he was trying to get off with someone who was less posh, he said he came from West Hampstead. Just to emphasize the inequality. And he did this sort of instinctively, because it's more of a turn on, apparently, if there's some perceived inequality, which is quite interesting. And quite often we're attracted to people because they've got something we want. You know, I don't mean in terms of material things, but I mean, although that obviously sometimes plays a part, but I mean in terms of, you know, if you're very pent up, you're really taken with this serene person, you know, and what initially attracts us, oh, I love the serenity, is what might repel us in the end. So we go, oh my God, she just sits there. She doesn't do anything. She just sighs. Why isn't she more like me? So it's quite interesting the reasons we come up with being attracted to people, because they're usually the same ones we have for being repelled by them at the end. But equality, is that what we want for a working relationship? It's definitely what we need for a working society. But I'm not expert enough to be able to say that is true or not true.
What's it like though when you an ex-girlfriend once said to me, interestingly, she said, the bit I hated about being with you is we'd walk into a room and because you're on TV, everyone will want to talk to you. And, and it made me feel like, well, am I as important? It was kind of an honest sort of summary of what was going on. Obviously your husband is so famous, Grayson, and did these things ever become issues in relationships?
Well, it would become an issue if you didn't understand it, yeah, and didn't do things to compensate for it. Because I had to point out when people were pushing past me to get to him and I was pushed aside. And I said, did you notice that happen? He said, no. I said, well, can you look out for it and protect me from it a bit next time? Because, you know, we'd go to like an open night at the Tate or something, art gallery. Just on a date night, and a journalist would rush up and stand between us and go, oh, I really wanted to ask you, Grayson, about, and he sort of wouldn't have noticed. So I pointed it out to him, and then he was very good about it, and then he understood. And I had a word for it. I called it plus one syndrome. When he'd get invited to things and just have plus one on the envelope, I thought, oh, that's nice. Hello, I'm plus one. How do you do? It came to a bit of a head once when I was at a private view, an art private view somewhere, and an old friend from art college, my art college, came up to me and said, oh, hi. And I went, hi, you know, really pleased to see them. And then they said, I've always wanted to meet your husband. Oh. And I said, I'm fine. How are you? It's like, oh, sort of like, so I didn't matter in the moment, even though he was an old friend, hadn't seen for a few years, but all he wanted from me right then was, you know, introduction to my husband.
Yeah.
And he forgot, possibly because of booze or something, to say, and how are you? Yeah. I think actually this was a motivating force for me to do some creative work, because I thought, everybody sees your work because it's on display, but my work as a psychotherapist is all kind of like in private and nobody sees if I'm doing a good job or a bad job. It's sort of invisible. And I think it was from a sort of bruised ego, from narcissistic injury, as we call it, that I did my first graphic novel, which is called Couch Fiction, reissued by Penguin last November with new illustrations by my daughter. Couch Fiction shows a year in somebody's psychotherapy sessions, and I modelled the psychotherapist on me. And I thought, oh, it'd be so great to show off. But when I really looked into how I work as a psychotherapist, I had to come up against my weak points as a psychotherapist and where I always get it wrong. So I put all the mistakes that a therapist can make in too as well. So I thought, oh God, this is going to get laughed out of town because I'm obviously a very bad psychotherapist. But in fact, it didn't. So I was very happy when Susie Orbach, a very eminent psychotherapist, gave it a good review. I thought, yes, thank you. And I think that went a long way to me feeling more equal. You know, because I had some outside success as well. You know,
is that a problem in a relationship then? If you're not feeling equal, then that's...
I think it's again, it's the way you're treated by other people. It was the way I was treated by, people at receptions and in public as an add-on rather than an equal. Because we obviously feel ourselves to be equal to each other. And I felt like an add-on. And then there was an article about me in the bookseller once, and it was at a book launch for one of my books. And Grayson was actually wearing a sort of clown's outfit with a massive cod piece on it. He likes to dress up. And it said, Philippa Perry and friends celebrate the launch of her new book. I'm like, yes, at last he's got to, and friends. And he looked at it and he went, oh, I sort of know what you mean now. It's a bit, it isn't great, is it, just to be a plus one, an add-on? So I think it's something a couple needs to work through. And I've talked to quite a few partners of prominent people and how they deal with it. It's quite interesting. I talked to Jerry Hall about it once because obviously she's been on both sides of that. This was before she got off with Murdoch, but she's used to being Mick Jagger's partner. And then when they split up and she had partners, she sort of knew how they felt. When lots of people came up to her and ignored her boyfriend. How he must feel, and she was very good at looking after them.
That's what my ex said. She said the worst bit was once when she was introduced as Tim Lovejoy's girlfriend, and she was like, "What? I don't have a name anymore." And she sits
Yeah.
down that she
Well,
felt.
we all get this when we pick up the kids from school, don't we? And it's sort of like, oh, here's Flo's mum and Flo's dad. It's sort of
That's
like
true.
a lot of mothers think, have I lost my name? Yeah,
That's
you
true.
have.
You talk about love there, and it's obviously one of the most important things about being a human. We need, I've said this quite a bit recently, we need warmth, and we need food, we need shelter, we need those things, and we kind of need love. And it seems that as society, we are just not regarding love very highly anymore. Maybe we've turned it into, if you put on the TV, it's turned into a game all the time, like, can you fall in love here? And Hollywood's redesigned love to make it into, unless your heart's pounding 100 miles an hour or something, you're not in love. And do you think we've lost the way a bit with how important love is?
And there's several different types of love, and erotic love seems to be promoted above, say, pragmatic love. And I think that is possibly misleading about what life is like. And people, when they make the transition from erotic love to something more pragmatic, pragmatic and possibly even deeper, think that, oh, this isn't right. It's got to be erotic love for 50 years. And actually, 18 months, 2 years, after that, you have to sort of decide to have sex together rather than rush on the on lust. Yeah, it is given the wrong emphasis in society. I agree with you about that. And I think that feeling of getting used to another person that takes decades is really beautiful and so subtle that it doesn't get the attention that the excitement and the storylines of erotic love gets. So we need to make more stories up about it. We need more narratives about pragma. Doesn't sell as much as erotica, though, pragma, does it?
That's true. And I wonder what we're all striving for as well. I remember going
What,
to
in a relationship, you mean?
in society. Really, really, it's a big topic, but it's just
Striving in what way?
Well, it seems we're striving very much for material gains.
Oh, yeah.
Yet the thing we're missing out most of all is like we're getting rid of, we're deciding to live on our own. We're getting rid of communities, aren't we? And we're really getting rid of families, and we're deciding to go it alone. Yeah, I mean, you know this when people have children now. That it used to be, what was the expression? It takes a village to bring up a child.
Yeah.
Now you're on your own in a flat while your husband's out doing work for you know,
Yeah.
and you're on your parental leave, then you're hoping he gets some as well so you can juggle it, and you're
Yeah.
juggling the sleep. Gone are the days that you all lived in the same village or the same postcode, and
Yeah.
so things have changed a lot in that way, haven't they, do you think?
Yeah, I think I talk a lot in my book about how to make up for the lack of support and the lack of society when you have a new baby. I mean, very often people have moved house because they're having a baby, so they're in with unfamiliar neighbours. And I talk a lot in my book about the effort that's necessary to make new connections. Even online connections are better than no connections. You know, a WhatsApp parental group has made many a person feel a bit better in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So it's very important to have a support system, as especially as a parent. But we all need people that we can share our joys and share our disappointments with. They make life worth living.
I live in London, and I think what are they called? Are they called MPL groups? N something. Those groups called where you're a mum and you're about to give birth and you all come together to learn how you're going to give birth. I can't remember what they're called now.
Oh, well, I belong to one called the Leche League, but that's not the most important. But they're sort of, I know what you mean. They have got an initial, and it's where it's how people make friends that stay friends for life, actually. Those sort of like baby classes, they're great.
I can't think what they're called, but all the time down my high street, you see six mothers walking all together, and you think you all went to that group together, and it's nice. Seems you've
Yeah.
taken over from the
My
family, that support.
sister is still. You know, she's what is she? She's over 65 now, and all the kids have got, I mean, you know, they're all grannies now. She's kept in contact with her baby class group, and they've
Yeah.
turned it into a book group now. But they meet like twice a month, and it's such a wonderful friendship group she's got with them. It's fantastic.
I went to on my one baby, but let's call it baby class. I can't think of the initials, but I went to breastfeeding classes because the partners were there to support as well. And I learned about children making their way to the boob, which is in your book as well, and
Yeah.
how as soon as they're born, the baby can smell and go all the way straight
Yeah.
and start bonding immediately. I also love the bit in your book as well, because I think a lot of dads go through this, where they suddenly go, "Well, the kid doesn't even like me," or the
Yeah.
children don't even want to be near me. What's my point in being here? And it hits your ego quite hard, but you point out it's part of the bonding process, isn't
Well, the thing is, they haven't got much nuances of feeling. It's sort of like
it?
we all love people differently. I mean, I feel slightly different with each of my friends in a way that I can appreciate. We like people when we like ourselves when we're with them. And
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that.
mum will f make baby feel a certain way, and dad will make baby feel a certain way. And maybe all baby wants to feel is having milk going in and being and the smell of mum. That is best. But don't worry, it doesn't last. You know, it's very soon that dad's the one that makes you feel excited because of kicking a ball around or whatever it is. And you just fluctuate between parents of which one you like best when you're growing up. And it's certainly a time to take a child's preferences seriously, but not personally. In fact, that is such a good mantra when you are a parent. Take your kids very seriously, but don't take it personally. Either when they say you're the best daddy in the whole world, or they say, I hate you. You know, it's lovely that they feel free to say either of those things.
I think everything goes in fashions. I always say this to Simon Rimmer on my Sunday brunch. I say food's just fashionable, isn't it? Like sage is so out of fashion. No one ever uses it.
Oh, I love a bit of fried sage on things. Yum.
Fried
if you
sage,
fry it, it makes a nice little crispy topping with a little flavour in it.
Maybe you'll come back in the moment.
It will now.
Yeah, exactly. It's all coriander and stuff like that. But parenting is also, it seems to be something which has gone in fashions, clearly because of the way the world is and society. But when I was younger and my parents were younger, and they weren't probably acknowledged that much. When I was younger, we did what our parents did. My generation, we have put our children on pedestals. Our weekends are based about running around for them to do their sporting activities.
I could never do that.
But what's interesting
it's not that good.
What's interesting about it is it seems that to be a good parent, you have to suffer. This is what's happening in the school playground and things.
Get my book out in the school playground, because your kids will be happier when you're happier. So you have to be not child-based, not parent priority, not child priority, relationship priority. And I know all about this. Being a sort of glorified taxi driver doesn't seem much fun to me when you take them to all sorts of activities. And we're so lucky, like, you know, in non-pandemic times that we live in London, because my daughter could work all the buses by age 9, so I never took her or picked her up from anything. She went on her own.
Wow.
The only time she did was when I freaked out about the idea of going on a night bus. So if it was late, like after 9 or something, I go, no, I'm picking you up. She said, I can manage perfectly well. I said, I know you can, but it's for my sake. I have to pick you up.
That's good. But you know what's happening, though? The parents are, it's a competition now. You know, everyone's in competition with their children as well, which I find.
In competition with their children?
No, I mean with using their children in competition. On one of my WhatsApp groups was how good everybody's child is at reading. And they're all trying to outdo each other. But the realization is your children are a year apart in age. I mean, there should be some differences in how they're developing. But then you've got that I'm suffering more. I haven't gone on holiday, or I haven't gone out. This is the one. I haven't gone out for 2 years because I just look after my children or something. It's like, well, get a life and do something about it, you know? But it does seem to be a fashionable thing at the moment. Anyway, the point I wanted to get onto, which is an interesting, again, in your book, which I think is so important, is being a good role model. One of your jobs, am I right in saying, one of your jobs as a parent is to show your children that when they grow up, they can have a life as good as yours?
Well, hopefully better. But yeah, I was talking to Josh Whittacombe and Rob somebody or other the other day on their podcast, and their kids were always mortified when they had to leave for work. And it's so tempting to say, I have to go to work so we've got money so I can buy you things and we can eat and pay the mortgage. But I think that's not the whole picture and not the whole truth. I think it's good to show that you enjoy your life and go, not only do I have to go to work so we can eat, but I actually like it and I'll see you when I get back. You know, I think we shouldn't pretend work is this bad thing, and if we should show that that work can be enjoyed. I think that's a great model to give your kids. It's quite difficult for kids to overtake their parents. Like, I think this is where as an adult, imposter syndrome comes from. If, say, you do something like your parents didn't do, like in my case, write a book, you've got this big voice inside of you saying, who am I to write a book? So I think it's really important not to allow your kids the illusion that you are the pinnacle of human achievement. I think I held that view quite a lot that I was growing up, and they did nothing to disabuse me of it. So I think, yeah, we are models for our kids. And if we enjoy our work, whether it's because we enjoy our colleagues or we enjoy the actual work we're doing, I think we should share that we like work. And if possible, we should take our kids to work. Very difficult to take your kid to work if you're a psychotherapist, but
I
Not
suppose.
so much if you're a greengrocer, you can then.
My name's Joe, and I secretly recorded my boyfriend.
I don't know any names of women that are good looking.
I'm not joking. He really doesn't know about this.
Like Tom Cruise is a good looking bloke.
Any closer to home?
Closer to home.
Join me and my two friends every week as we share far too much about our personal lives.
One of the first things him saying to me is that I'm not like other girls that he's been with.
That's great.
They were naturally pretty, whereas you do look better with makeup on.
Oh my days.
Search I Secretly Recorded My Boyfriend wherever you get your podcasts and tell everyone. Just don't tell him.
You?
Yeah, me.
No, you're on about pretty as in pretty.
Just think about it. Talking about fashion, psychotherapy must have fashions. I don't think you all probably spout Freud as much as people used to. It must think.
Oh, some of us are very fond of Freud because even if we disagree with everything he says, he was the first person that got us talking about it, and he was a great foundation. Even if we've moved away from some of his beliefs, like, you know, we've let drive theory go. And things like that.
What's drive theory? I don't know.
Oh, things like we're motivated by, you know, Thanatos, which is the death drive and stuff like that. You know, okay. we've let all that stuff go a bit. Mm. But it is sometimes it's good if somebody says something so you can learn from that what you're not. You know, if you don't agree with it, you can still learn from it. Fashions in psychotherapy. Well, I think the most fashionable cutting edge of therapy at the moment is relational psychotherapy. So that is to say, everything happens in the relationship. There was a huge fashion a while back that is waning somewhat for CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. This was in sort of non-relational therapy, whereby you were who you were because of the way you talked to yourself. So if you came to any conclusions, you had to look at those belief systems and perhaps challenge them. And you had to do homework and write it all down. And this was quite successful for about 6 months. And then people would just usually relapse, but they only do the studies up to 6 months. So it looked amazing, but then they stopped doing it after that. And in fact, a lot of people's, you know, dissatisfaction and depression, it gets lodged in the brain in a pre-verbal way, in a non-verbal way. So it's not about how you talk to yourself. It's more about your default mood. And so if it's not language-based, then it isn't based in how you're talking to yourself. So CBT isn't good for that. I'm not saying it's terrible and a lot of people get a lot of stuff from it, but I think relational is where it's at now.
Do you worry about giving information out? I mean, advice, sorry. I mean, people sometimes ask me for my advice and I always go, yeah, I'll give you my advice, but remember you're taking off a TV presenter, which is a terrible idea. But you're trained. Do you ever worry when you're giving out advice, you're sitting in your sessions or you're writing this book?
I don't know that. I mean, I do give advice. We're not supposed to, as psychotherapists, give advice. It's very difficult not to. But I hope I qualify it by saying if I were you rather than you should.
Right.
But I rarely give advice. I'm more likely to say, have you thought of it this way? Or like I said to you earlier, oh, that's a belief system. You know, it's sort of like a little gentle challenge there rather than actual advice.
All right, talking about belief systems then, I saw you tweeted the other day about dreams. They're important.
Oh, I love dreams. Love them.
People discuss it a lot. Explain, because we don't really know, well, maybe you do, 100% what dreams are. Explain why you, what you think they're
okay, there. Dreams, a short lecture by P. Perry. Here I go.
I'm ready.
Just flex the muscles. Get ready for this. Okay. Ah, ready, steady, go. Right. Never tell me you have no imagination, because you know what you dream is fantastical. Dreams are metaphors for what's going on with you, because they come from a part of the brain that is not your verbal calculating part of your brain, the more of your sort of thinking, more of your sort of feeling embodied brain, if you like. So they only come to you in metaphors. And every person and every object in your dream is a part of you because you dreamt it. It came from the fountain of you. So that suppose you have a dream whereby you're being chased by an evil policeman down the street, and when he gets you, he's going to kill you. What I say to someone who has that sort of dream is that retell the dream from the point of view of the policeman, because the policeman is a part of you that you are projecting out onto the world at the moment. So retell the dream. So I'm a policeman. I'm chasing Tim down the street. When I get him, I'm going to tell him what a jolly good chap he is and what a great job he's doing. You go, what? I thought you were going to kill me. No, no, I'm on your side, mate. You can find out so much more when you retell the dream as though it's still happening in the present tense from the point of view of every other person in the dream. And sometimes even from the point of view of the house or the table. You just, it's amazing what you can find out because you dreamt it. It's part of you. Find out more about you from the dream. Another sort of dream people have is they're looking for a lavatory, and every lavatory they find is absolutely filthy and disgusting and they can't use it.
I've had that dream so often.
Have you?
Yeah, what is it?
Okay, that's you wanting to go to the loo and your body's saying, no, you need to sleep longer. So we're not going to wake you up. You're going to sleep longer because we're not going to find a loo for you to go with. So that's just to keep you asleep.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You get quite a lot of dreams like that. For instance, you can dream that the alarm is a ship leaving the port just so you don't wake up for that alarm, you know, things like that. Freud's great thing about dreams was that they were wish fulfillment. He said, anything you dream, it's for something you want. And if you told him a dream that seemed to really disprove that, he said, you had that dream because you really wanted to prove me wrong. That was your wish. You know, he'd get round it somehow. Yes. So that is my short lecture on dreams.
All right. I'm conscious we're running out of time, and there's something that I really want to just talk about before we conclude the conversation, but it's about feelings, because what I love the most about your book is talking to your feeling what your child feels. And bizarrely, I feel that's a great metaphor for the world we're at the moment. There seems to be no empathy for anything going on anywhere. Like when you see people go to the Capitol, let's pick America because it's easier to look upon there, and you see those people going in there, rather than think, let's stick them in prison, lock away the key, go, how did they get to that belief system that they wanted to walk into the place that they think is so important to their lives, democracy? They wanted to go and bring it down. How have they got there? Where's the empathy for why people get there? And I think, you know, that's a long way away from where you're looking at your child and trying to help with their feelings, but it's also so heavily connected.
We shy away from doing that because we think, oh my God, that's going to take a long time. But really, it's the shortest way to solve the problem, even if it does take a long time. So, for instance, I'm getting a little bit fed up with all the right-minded Remainers going, I told you so, I told you so, still with no sympathy for people that felt so disenfranchised and so as though they didn't count, that they wanted to be seen and tell the Prime Minister of the time, David Cameron, that they hated him. Yeah. And because they were marginalised and they had no hope and they had no sense of country to fight for or sense of community, because, you know, every community thing had been taken from them. And so we never sympathize with how disenfranchised people felt and how they felt that everybody was calling them stupid. And so I think maybe we deserve the revenge reaped on us. And wouldn't it be better if we all, instead of competing with, you know, always having somebody who's right and somebody is wrong, if instead we found out where people came from and what motivated them to do things, and then we could learn to compromise and collaborate and cooperate rather than prove people wrong, which never lasts. They tend to rise up in anger. People don't like to be humiliated. So I think we should stop the politics of humiliation and see how we can compromise and cooperate so that people don't feel left out. Because when people feel left out, they become dangerous.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And also taking that to children, when they're angry or they're annoyed, try and feel what they're feeling is what the point you make, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of like when your kid says there's monsters under the bed, oh God, you just want her to go to sleep so you can have a glass of wine. But I feel for you in that, okay? But monsters under the bed are just her way of saying something isn't quite right. And before we learn to be articulate, we do speak in metaphors. And she's not lying. There are monsters under the bed. And we need to know their names and what they're likely to do. And we need to tell stories about them so we can contain them and own them rather than them owning us, you know. So monsters under the bed are real, everybody.
A couple of quick questions. Well, I ask a lot of my guests. What's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life?
Don't think I've got a rigid rule about anything. Be flexible. I've just given myself that.
Okay, that's good. Just one, because I ask, I do this other podcast where I do 15 questions. And one of the questions, my favourite questions, is, have you ever seen a UFO or a ghost? And I just feel that I'd like to understand if you've ever seen one of those or know if you've ever seen
one. I actually did a programme that's on BBC iPlayer at the moment, actually, about how come we do believe in ghosts.
Oh, go on.
About the paranormal. And it was, I did it about the Victorian mind in the 1890s. It's called Victorian Sensations, Seeing and Believing. So if you want to find out all about ghosts and ghosties and why we believe in it, or some of us believe in them, please go to that BBC4 documentary I made on the very subject.
Well, that's brilliant. Is it on iPlayer now?
It's on iPlayer for another 25 days.
Oh,
and the time, I don't know what the date, and it's now the 27th, so it'll be there till about the 20th of February, I think.
Okay, well, I'll try and get this out sooner rather than later. And final question, what is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life is what you make it. And it's our, life isn't, you know, meaningless because, you know, we're primordial soup that happened to have been made into people by some kind of chemical accident. So it is our job to find meaning, and it's really important to find meaning because it gives us a reason for living. So the meaning of life is to find meaning and make your own meaning. That is your job.
Thank you so much. If people want to follow you, I mean, they want to get your book, the book you wish your parents had read. But if they want to follow you, is the best place Twitter?
Instagram? Twitter. I'm on the Twitter. I am on Instagram as the book you wish, but I never post anything on there.
Right.
I quite like Twitter because it's sort of instant interacting. So at Philippa, PHILIPPA _ Perry.
Thank you so much for joining me today. Loads of food for thought. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. Very nice.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quokka. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.